things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
My uncle was a big Doctor Strange collector, and he left a number of those issues around the house for me to read, in particular the ones drawn by Gene Colan. And one time they had a crossover between Marvel's Tomb of Dracula book and Doctor Strange, so that helped me to transition into the Dracula book. I didn't pick up any Draculas off the newsstand, but they tended to turn up at flea markets when I was growing up, and I bought a lot of those later issues. It was one of the earliest series that I collected. I know I had at least one issue of the late 70s 2001 A Space Odyssey series that Jack Kirby wrote and drew, because that, I think, is where I developed my lack of appreciation for Kirby. It was too weird for me. It was probably not his best work art-wise, and so I tended to associate Kirby with weird, goofy concepts that didn't relate to me. I know I picked up DC Special Series number 2 at a flea market in Houston, and I remember flipping through it outside on a sunny day. This was a collection of the first two major Len Wein, Bernie Wrightson, Swamp Thing stories. Had a cool wraparound cover. It felt like a thick book. It was heavy duty, and I liked the darkness. I loved the sinewy quality of Wrightson, Swamp Thing. And I can't recall if I bought the book before or after I checked out the early 80s series. One might have contributed to the other, but I know that my preference was very much for these earlier stories, and still is, to be frank. If I recall correctly, I managed to pick up another copy of this book in recent years. I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it again, but I look forward to the opportunity. I'm not sure I ended up with a copy of 1978's The Brave and the Bold number 145. It was my introduction to the Phantom Stranger, possibly my introduction to Jim Aparo and Bob Haney. I actually own a copy of the story. It doesn't hold up all that great. I don't remember very much about it, even though I now own another copy of it. The Phantom Stranger came off as cool. It's neat seeing Batman deal with supernatural elements, and I think that they were smart in trying to play it to where it could have been science-based or supernatural-based threat, even though the fellow was, you know, the main issue was he was using voodoo dolls against our heroes. I know I bought at least one copy of Marvel Comics Group's Fun and Games magazine, which is a bit of a misnomer because it was in a comic book format and it was full color. Not necessarily what you'd expect. I don't know if it was issue 5, which was cover dated January 1980, or issue 11, cover dated July 1980, but I definitely had at least one of those books because it floated around my household for a number of years. This was an activity magazine full of crosswords and word searches and the type of stuff you would find in a newspaper, but with a Marvel hero-centric vibe to it, and of course lots of Marvel artwork. It occurs to me I've never heard anybody else ever reference the Marvel Fun and Games magazine, but it did exist. It did run for a little over a year. I never bought another one. I'm not even sure if I ever saw another one on the newsstand again after that. 1980s Wonder Woman number 267. Again, I remember getting this in a 3-pack, which I probably got at a local grocery store. I have no recollection of what the other two books would have been. Looking through Mike's Amazing World of Comics, I couldn't find any other books that might have been in that 3-pack, because I distinctly remember having that one in 1984. We were living in a trailer at that time, and it was a book that I revisited it often. I believe it was the first Wonder Woman comic I ever owned. It was my introduction to Animal Man, who I slowly over the years got away from, but whenever he would pop up in the 80s before he had his own series and became something other than what I'd been introduced to, which was Stuntman with animal powers without all the weird meta stuff that Grant Morrison would bring to him, I always pinged, "Hey, look, it's Animal Man." It didn't happen that often, though. Let's face it, it was Animal Man before Grant Morrison touched him. Story was by Jerry Conway. Art was by Jose Delbo and Vince Coletta. Once again, it was Coletta'd up, but I liked Delbo's Wonder Woman quite a bit, possibly because he was my introductory artist to the character. At one point, Wonder Woman uses her lasso as a fan. Enemy agent tries to shoot her in the face with a gas gun, and she whirs the gas away to save herself. I like that inventive use of the lasso. I dug the opportunity to see Animal Man's origin story. It was just a fun book, and it stuck with me as a kid, and it made me positively inclined toward Wonder Woman, which the television series had obviously done as well. For me, it was great to have a Wonder Woman comic. The only bummer was that I didn't have an opportunity to buy Wonder Woman off the newsstand. I don't remember ever really seeing Wonder Woman comics on the newsstand. I would either get them from other people that I'd met, or later on, years down the line, I would often get them at comic book shops, but it was hard to find that book on the newsstand. Most DC books in the 1980s here in Texas. 1981's Marvel Super Heroes 97. That was the Incredible Hulk's reprint book, I believe that in the early 80s, there were reprinting stories from the early 70s. And these things were all over the place when I was a kid. This specific issue was written by Archie Goodwin with art by Herb Trimpe and John Severin. And it was a story of Jarella in the micro world that she lived in, where everybody was green and the Hulk was a hero. I hated the comic intensely as a kid. I hated all of those early 70s reprints of the Hulk stories. It made me very negatively disposed toward the Hulk. I don't know why this specific issue stuck in my head so much, probably because of Jarella, but yeah, hated this comic and hated many comics like it. Took me another 10 to 14 years, I guess, to actually pick up a Hulk comic, enjoy it, and start liking that character. Okay, this is the huge one. I loved Indiana Jones as a kid. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in the theater. I have a whole slew of geek-centric movies that I went to as a kid that I managed to fall asleep during, including Superman and Star Wars, but I stayed wide awake for all of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I bought the little action figures when they came out. I bought the Indiana Jones doll. I adored Raiders of the Lost Ark. Indy was my role model as a kid. The best find was found at Woolworths. Raiders of the Lost Ark. The original issue was released in the summer of 1981. I picked it up as part of a three-pack with all three issues, which was great. I wish that the three-packs as a kid had done that more often, collecting three consecutive issues. The three books comprise the official Marvel Comics adaptation of the motion picture. The writer was Walt Simonson. Art was by John Buscema and Klaus Janson, who were a pretty damn solid combo. Back in the days before you had VHS tapes, them showing Raiders of the Lost Ark on TV would happen once or twice a year. This was the way that you could relive the action and adventure of that story. Pick it up and read it. I read it many, many times. It was one of my favorite comic books. I also remember fishing out a copy of For Your Eyes Only from a quarter bin at a flea market. This one was by Larry Hama with art by Howard Chaykin, if you can believe that, but he's all Vince Colletted up, unfortunately. I bought the first issue. I never found a second issue. Never particularly wanted to find a second issue. It was not the Raiders of the Lost Ark caliber of an adaptation.
Didn't buy any comics early in March of 1982. The only one that was a maybe was The Saga of Swamp Thing number 2. I always had a weakness for photo covers. I loved that Fumetti style. And they were promoting the movie at the time, so they went ahead and threw a photo of Dick Darroch in costume on there. I don't remember the story, and I might have fished it out of a long box years later, so it didn't really count. The one thing I was picking up, not off the newsstand, but published in this time period and recently enough that I'm willing to count it in these features, was The Warlord, a run from issues 58 through 61. Mike Rowe was doing a riff on The Man in the Iron Mask. Travis Morgan had been replaced by a duplicate, and Morgan was locked up in this cool spiked helmet and chains in a dungeon, or the fake Travis Morgan was slapping around the real one's girlfriend and basically getting up to shenanigans. Meanwhile, Morgan's son, who he didn't know was alive, he believed he had been killed by Deimos years earlier, was running around getting up to stuff, and there was this whole soap opera aspect where Morgan doesn't know his son's alive, the son doesn't know that he's royalty, kind of a Game of Thrones sort of thing. I wonder if Mike Rowe was reading George R. R. Martin at the time. Fun art. I enjoyed it. I was buying it from a flea market. I'm going to mention flea markets a lot in this series, so I'll make a point of saying this was the flea market that was closest to my house. It was off the Gold Freeway, and I have a lot of good memories about that place because I had a lot of my early comics there. And my first ever girlfriend, I bought her a gold cross as a gift from there. Anyway, this was my main home base when it came to buying non-new, non-newsstand comics, and I got that whole run of issues from there from a little mom-and-pop place that was selling them for probably 20, 25 cents a piece. I think the original, you know, newsstand price was like 40, 50 cents. But it was a good arc. I enjoyed it. I never could read the stinking Orion backups. I'd look at it, toss it the pages, couldn't get it myself invested enough to actually bother to read the things, or if I did, they left no impression on me. I have no memory of them. But I did enjoy that one little run of Warlord, and I had an affection for the character for a long time after that, but whenever I would try to read it again, it never drew me in. So I guess I enjoyed The Man with the Iron and the Iron Mask bit more than I enjoyed the premise of the book itself. You know, the Warlord is supposed to be this pilot who's lost in a savage land, and he's fighting medieval-type. Doesn't matter. Moving on. April of 82, I tried to make up for the lack of books the previous month. I picked up DC Comics Presents number 47, which was a team-up between Superman and Masters of the Universe. Now, around the same time, Marvel was having a great deal of success with G.I. Joe, and Masters of the Universe was huge when I was a kid. It was, you know, right there with G.I. Joe. It could have been a huge property for DC. DC had been chasing a property like that for years. They'd lost that on Conan. They'd lost that on Star Wars. So their idea of pushing Masters of the Universe, once they got that license, was to team it up with Superman in this staid, crummy, boring special. Paul Kupperberg wrote it. I've never been a huge fan of Paul Kupperberg as a writer. Kurt Swan drew it. A Kid in 1982 was not looking for a Kurt Swan fix. I'm sorry, even with Mike DiCarlo inking it. There's also this problem because at the end of the story, Superman throws the Sword of Power and it embeds itself in Skeletor's chest. So as a kid, I'm like, oh my god, they just killed Skeletor. That was the only cool thing that happened in the book. It was never followed up on, but for a year or so there, I was like, they killed Skeletor in this comic book! And nothing came of it. There's a backup strip that featured whatever happened to Sandy the Golden Boy, who was Sandman's kid sidekick. Nothing. Meant absolutely nothing to me. I have no remembrance of that. That same month, I got The Brave and the Bold number 188. That was an appearance by The Rose and the Thorn. The issue was drawn by Jim Aparo, so you know I'm going to love that. But it had this wonderfully evocative title, A Grave as Wide as the World. How cool is that? And the cover itself, Batman is in a grave, and a Nazi is picking up a tombstone and about to crush Batman's skull with it. The Thorn is rushing him, trying to stop him. You know, this is 1982. You've got Raiders of the Lost Ark. Everybody's into the Nazis again. And it was an origin story for Rose and Thorn. It was okay. Everything goes better with Jim Aparo, but Robert Kanigher's scripts never grabbed me the way some of the other writers did. Certainly wasn't crazy like Bob Haney's stuff. And Rose and Thorn, the premise, I've always had trouble with characters that have major psychological breaks, because there's always this element of they didn't choose to be the way they are. And I like characters that are self-determined. A friend of mine must have had access to a comic shop, because he used to pick up Marvel Fanfare, and I remember looking through his copies of those Mike Golden drawn first issues that had Kazar and the Savage Land, and they were pretty cool, and certainly the production value was incredible. I'd never seen a book like that, because it's printed on all cover stock, so every page is glossy and white, and comics just didn't look like that back then. But I didn't buy it myself, so. He also had a copy of Avengers number 221, and I never got to read his copy, but I just loved that cover so much. This was the one where it was, I believe, an all-red cover in the background, and then you had these little white boxes. There was a checklist of various superheroes that could potentially become Avengers. You have this urge. You want to check off those checkboxes. You want to figure out which of those options would be the best for you, and it gets to the heart of being a fanboy. So even though I don't believe I ever read the story, that cover is one that I adored as a kid because of that interactive quality to it. Another book that I didn't actually buy was Avengers number 222. My grandmother used to go to a beauty salon, and that would obviously take a lot of time because she had a big beehive hairstyle, so they'd have to tease that up and she'd be under the little hot air dealing for a while. Kind of left my own devices, and thankfully this place had comic books. And this one specific issue was there, so I probably didn't actually read it that May. It was cool because it has the Masters of Evil. You always want your super team to have an opposing super team to fight, and for some reason, neither the Avengers nor the Justice League have ever fully embraced that notion. They never seem to have a fully opposite number, or they'll have one and they'll let it fall into disuse. So this being an early comic book for me, and getting to see the Avengers fighting a group called the Masters of Evil was a real turn-on. I dug Scorpion, I dug Moonstone, I dug Tiger Shark, Doug Whirlwind. I just had a soft spot for those characters ever since I was a kid, and it didn't hurt. The book was drawn by Greg LaRocque, who is a really solid artist, but he's never going to be the guy that people rush to. But when you combine him with Brett Breeding, who's a fantastic inker, a guy who never got his full acclaim that he deserved, those two together, magic. And you also had a Jim Shooter plot, Stephen Grant script. Nothing to lose on there, except maybe for Egghead. Egghead was in that issue. Yeah, the Ant-Man never had any good villains.
One that I believe I forgot about was Weird War Tales number 115, which was released in the summer of 1982. I've managed to pin that down. I knew I'd read at least one Creature Commandos comic, but I wasn't sure which one it was, so I made a point of going through the various Weird War Tales until I found the exact one. But the title, You Can't Pin a Medal on a Robot, definitely stuck with me. It was a team-up with the Creature Commandos and G.I. Robot. It was written by Bob Kanigher, and it had that heavy vibe that Kanigher would bring to his war stories. Very sad, very morose. These guys are freaks. They're fighting for their country or countries. I'm not sure. It's been so long since I've read the book. They're still hated and isolated because they're beastlings. There's a guy who got shot up and became something of a Frankenstein's monster. There's a girl who was cursed, I think, on a Greek island, and so she ended up with Medusa hair full of snakes. There was a werewolf. There was a vampire. And then he had G.I. Robot on top of that, who could shoot bullets out of his fingertips and knock out airplanes. I don't think I ever got the opportunity to buy another copy of Weird War Tales. I don't remember it having much distribution. This one I recall picking up off of a newsstand at a convenience store, and I don't think it was one that I usually frequented. So I bought the one book, I enjoyed it, and then it was lost within a couple of years of my having gotten it.
So anyway, that covers March, April, and May of 1982. So if you have any memories from that time period, feel free to leave a comment, and hope you enjoyed what I had to say. Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy, what memories?